Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga, continuing in Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 3, Self-Surrender in Works, The Way of the Gita, picking up on page 98. A distinction has to be firmly seized in our consciousness, the capital distinction between mechanical nature and the free lord of nature, between the Ishwara, or single luminous divine will, and the many executive modes and forces of the universe. Nature, not as she is in her divine truth, the conscious power of the eternal, but as she appears to us in the ignorance, is executive force, mechanical in her steps, not consciously intelligent to our experience of her, although all her works are instinct with an absolute intelligence. Not in herself master, she is full of a self-aware power. This power is the conscious divine Shakti of the Ishwara, the transcendent and universal mother, which has an infinite mastery, and because of this power driving her, she rules all and exactly fulfills the work intended in her by the Ishwara. Not enjoying, but enjoyed, she bears in herself the burden of all enjoyments. Nature, as Prakriti, is an inertly active force, for she works out a movement imposed upon her, but within her is one that knows. Some entity sits there that is aware of all her motion and process. Prakriti works, containing the knowledge, the mastery, the delight of the Purusha, the being associated with her or seated within her. But she can participate in them only by subjection and reflection of that which fills her. Purusha knows and is still and inactive. He contains the action of Prakriti within his consciousness and knowledge and enjoys it. He gives the sanction to Prakriti's works, and she works out what is sanctioned by him for his pleasure. Purusha himself does not execute. He maintains Prakriti in her action and allows her to express in energy and process and formed result what he perceives in his knowledge. This is the distinction made by the Sankhyas. And although it is not all the true truth, not in any way the highest truth either of Purusha or Prakriti, still it is a valid and indispensable practical knowledge in the lower hemisphere of existence. The individual soul, or the conscious being in a form, may identify itself with this experiencing Purusha or with this active Prakriti. If it identifies itself with Prakriti, it is not master, enjoyer, and knower, but reflects the modes and workings of Prakriti. It enters, by its identification, into that subjection and mechanical working which is characteristic of her. And even by an entire immersion in Prakriti, this soul becomes inconscient or subconscient, asleep in her forms as in the earth and the metal, or almost asleep as in plant life. There, in that inconscience, it is subject to the domination of tamas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of obscurity and inertia. Sattva and Rajas are there, but they are concealed in the thick coating of tamas. Emerging into its own proper nature of consciousness, but not yet truly conscious, because there is still too great a domination of tamas in the nature, the embodied being becomes more and more subject to rajas, the principle, the power, the qualitative mode of action and passion impelled by desire and instinct. There is then formed and developed the animal nature, narrow in consciousness, rudimentary in intelligence, rajaso-tamasic in vital habit and impulse. Emerging yet farther from the great unconscious towards a spiritual status, the embodied being liberates sattva, the mode of light, and acquires a relative freedom and mastery and knowledge, and with it a qualified and conditioned sense of inner satisfaction and happiness. Man, the mental being in a physical body, should be, but is not, except in a few among this multitude of ensouled bodies, of this nature. Ordinarily, he has too much in him of the obscure earth inertia and a troubled, ignorant animal life force to be a soul of light and bliss, or even a mind of harmonious will and knowledge. There is here in man an incomplete and still hampered and baffled ascension towards the true character of the Purusha, free, master, knower, and enjoyer. For these are in human and earthly experience relative modes, none giving its single and absolute fruit. All are intermixed with each other, and there is not the pure action of any one of them anywhere. It is their confused and inconstant interaction that determines the experiences of the egoistic human consciousness swinging in nature's uncertain balance. The sign of the immersion of the embodied soul in Prakriti is the limitation of consciousness to the ego. The vivid stamp of this limited consciousness can be seen in a constant inequality of the mind and heart, and a confused conflict and disharmony in their varied reactions to the touches of experience. The human reactions sway perpetually between the dualities created by the soul's subjection to nature and by its often intense but narrow struggle for mastery and enjoyment, a struggle for the most part ineffective. The soul circles in an unending round of nature's alluring and distressing opposites, success and failure, good fortune and ill fortune, good and evil, sin and virtue, joy and grief, pain and pleasure. It is only when, awaking from its immersion in Prakriti, it perceives its oneness with the One, and its oneness with all existences, that it can become free from these things, and found its right relation to this executive world nature. Then it becomes indifferent to her inferior modes, equal-minded to her dualities, capable of mastery and freedom. It is seated above her as the high-throned knower and witness, filled with the calm, intense, unalloyed delight of his own eternal existence. The embodied spirit continues to express its powers in action, but it is no longer involved in ignorance, no longer bound by its works. Its actions have no longer a consequence within it, but only a consequence outside in Prakriti. The whole movement of nature becomes to its experience a rising and falling of waves on the surface that make no difference to its own unfathomable peace, its wide delight, its vast universal equality, or its boundless God existence. It is not indispensable for the Karma Yoga to accept implicitly all the philosophy of the Gita. We may regard it, if we like, as a statement of psychological experience useful as a practical basis for the yoga. Here, it is perfectly valid and in entire consonance with a high and wide experience. For this reason, I have thought it well to state it here, as far as possible, in the language of modern thought, omitting all that belongs to metaphysics rather than to psychology. These are the conditions of our effort, and they point to an ideal which can be expressed in these or in equivalent formulae. To live in God and not in the ego. To move vastly founded, not in the little egoistic consciousness, but in the consciousness of the all soul and the transcendent. To be perfectly equal in all happenings and to all beings, and to see and feel them as one with oneself and one with the divine, to feel all in oneself and all in God, to feel God in all, oneself in all, to act in God and not in the ego. And here, first, not to choose action by reference to personal needs and standards, but in obedience to the dictates of the living highest truth above us. Next, as soon as we are sufficiently founded in the spiritual consciousness, not to act any longer by our separate will or movement, but more and more to allow action to happen and develop under the impulsion and guidance of a divine will that surpasses us. And last, the supreme result, to be exalted into an identity in knowledge, force, consciousness, act, and joy of existence with the divine Shakti. To feel a dynamic movement, not dominated by mortal desire and vital instinct and impulse and elusive mental free will, but luminously conceived and evolved in an immortal self-delight and an infinite self-knowledge. For this is the action that comes by a conscious subjection and merging of the natural man into the divine self and eternal spirit. It is the spirit that forever transcends and guides this world nature. But by what practical steps of self-discipline can we arrive at this consummation, the elimination of all egoistic activity and of its foundation, the egoistic consciousness, is clearly the key to the consummation we desire. And since, in the path of works, action is the knot we have first to loosen, we must endeavor to loosen it where it is centrally tied, in desire and in ego. For otherwise we shall cut only stray strands and not the heart of our bondage. These are the two knots of our subjection to this ignorant and divided nature, desire and ego sense. And of these two, desire has its native home in the emotions and sensations and instincts, and from there affects thought and volition. Ego sense lives indeed in these movements, but it casts its deep roots also in the thinking mind and its will, and it is there that it becomes fully self-conscious. These are the twin obscure powers of the obsessing worldwide ignorance that we have to enlighten and eliminate. In the field of action, desire takes many forms, but the most powerful of all is the vital self's craving or seeking after the fruit of our works. The fruit we covet may be a reward of internal pleasure, It may be the accomplishment of some preferred idea or some cherished will, or the satisfaction of the egoistic emotions, or else the pride of success, of our highest hopes and ambitions. Or it may be an external reward, a recompense entirely material. Wealth, position, honor, victory, good fortune, or any other fulfillment of vital or physical desire. But all alike are lures by which egoism holds us. Always these satisfactions delude us with the sense of mastery and the idea of freedom, while really we are harnessed and guided or ridden and whipped by some gross or subtle, some noble or ignoble figure of the blind desire that drives the world. Therefore, the first rule of action laid down by the Gita is to do the work that should be done without any desire for the fruit, nishkama karma. A simple rule in appearance, and yet how difficult to carry out with anything like an absolute sincerity and liberating entireness. In the greater part of our action, we use the principle very little, if at all, and then even mostly as a sort of counterpoise to the normal principle of desire, and to mitigate the extreme action of that tyrant impulse. At best, we are satisfied if we arrive at a modified and disciplined egoism, not too shocking to our moral sense, not too brutally offensive to others. And to our partial self-discipline, we give various names and forms. We habituate ourselves by practice to the sense of duty, to a firm fidelity to principle, a stoical fortitude, or a religious resignation, a quiet or an ecstatic submission to God's will. But it is not these things that the Gita intends, useful though they are in their place. It aims at something absolute, unmitigated, uncompromising, a turn, an attitude that will change the whole poise of the soul. Not the mind's control of vital impulse is its rule, but the strong immobility of an immortal spirit. The test it lays down is an absolute equality of the mind and the heart to all results, to all reactions, to all happenings. If good fortune and ill fortune, if respect and insult, if reputation and obloquy, if victory and defeat, if pleasant event and sorrowful event leave us not only unshaken but untouched, free in the emotions, free in the nervous reactions, free in the mental view, not responding with the least disturbance or vibration in any spot of the nature, then we have the absolute liberation to which the Gita points us, but not otherwise. The tiniest reaction is a proof that the discipline is imperfect, and that some part of us accepts ignorance and bondage as its law, and clings still to the old nature. Our self-conquest is only partially accomplished. It is still imperfect or unreal in some stretch or part or smallest spot of the ground of our nature. And that little pebble of imperfection may throw down the whole achievement of the yoga. There are certain semblances of an equal spirit which must not be mistaken for the profound and vast spiritual equality which the Gita teaches. There is inequality of disappointed resignation, inequality of pride, inequality of hardness and indifference. All these are egoistic in their nature. Inevitably, they come in the course of the sadhana, but they must be rejected or transformed into the true quietude. There is, too, on a higher level, the equality of the stoic, the equality of a devout resignation or a sage detachment, the equality of a soul aloof from the world and indifferent to its doings. These two are insufficient. First approaches, they can be, but they are at most early soul phases only, or imperfect mental preparations for our entry into the true and absolute self-existent wide evenness of the spirit. For it is certain that so great a result cannot be arrived at immediately and without any previous stages. At first, we have to learn to bear the shocks of the world with the central part of our being untouched and silent. Even when the surface mind, heart, life are strongly shaken. Unmoved there on the bedrock of our life, we must separate the soul watching behind or immune deep within from these outer workings of our nature. Afterwards, extending this calm and steadfastness of the detached soul to its instruments, it will become slowly possible to radiate peace from the luminous center to the darker peripheries. In this process, we may take the passing help of many minor phases, a certain stoicism, a certain calm philosophy, a certain religious exaltation may help us toward some nearness to our aim. Or we may call in even less strong and exalted, but still useful, powers of our mental nature. In the end, we must either discard or transform them and arrive instead at an entire equality, a perfect self-existent peace within, and even, if we can, a total unassailable, self-poised, and spontaneous delight in all our members. But how then shall we continue to act at all? For ordinarily, the human being acts because he has a desire or feels a mental, vital, or physical want or need. He is driven by the necessities of the body, by the lust of riches, honors, or fame, or by a craving for the personal satisfactions of the mind or the heart, or a craving for power or pleasure. Or he is seized and pushed about by a moral need, or, at least, the need or the desire of making his ideas or his ideals or his will or his party or his country or his gods prevail in the world. If none of these desires, nor any other, must be the spring of our action, it would seem as if all incentive or motive power had been removed, and action itself must necessarily cease. The Gita replies with its third great secret of the divine life. All action must be done in a more and more Godward, and finally a God-possessed consciousness. Our works must be a sacrifice to the divine, and in the end a surrender of all our being, mind, will, heart, sense, life, and body to the One must make God-love and God-service our only motive. This transformation of the motive force and very character of works is indeed its master idea. It is the foundation of its unique synthesis of works, love, and knowledge. In the end, not desire, But the consciously felt will of the eternal remains as the sole driver of our action and the sole originator of its initiative. Equality, renunciation of all desire for the fruit of our works, action done as a sacrifice to the Supreme Lord of our nature and of all nature, these are the three first Godward approaches in the Gita's way of Karma Yoga. End of chapter 3, page 105.